Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our audiences online and on the radio. And it's my great pleasure tonight to introduce Diane Hales, the author of Mona Lisa, A Life Discovered. She also has won the, or been awarded, the Cavalieri Prize in Italy for her earlier book, La Bella Lingua. On the Italian language. So she is going to be speaking tonight about her interest, I won't call it obsession, but her interest in discovering something about Mona Lisa, something that has really, you know, driven a lot of people over the years. Who was she? Why did he pick her? Why is her smile so enigmatic? Why do we care so much about this one picture? What is so good about it? And why did Leonardo carry it around with him for his whole life until he died and left it in France, where it ended up in the Louvre. So, Diane Hales, thank you very much.
Well, I want to thank George for inviting me here, and I want to thank all of you for coming. I must say, I was a bit intimidated, because when I went online and I saw who had spoken here at the Commonwealth Club, I thought, oh my goodness. I said to my husband, who's a psychiatrist, do you know that Franklin Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower, Bill Gates, Jerry Brown, Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, they've all spoken at the Commonwealth Club, and then there's me. And this is what's wonderful about being married to a psychiatrist. He said, but Diane, you can trump them all because you're bringing someone more famous. So who was she? A genius immortalized her, a French king paid a fortune for her, an emperor coveted her, poets lauded her, singers crooned of her. Every year, millions of visitors trek to her portrait in the Louvre. No image has ever captivated so many for so long. But Mona Lisa is no mere masterpiece. No other artwork has had so many adventures and misadventures in and out of the frame. Leonardo da Vinci's elegant model has shed her stately robes and appeared in a beret, a burqa, a bridal gown, a sari, and for the gentlemen in the audiences, even a bikini. Now, Mona Lisa is as ancient as an Egyptian pharaoh, but she's also as modern as a motorcycle mama. Last year, NASA bounced Mona Lisa's image off the moon. Well, why not? She's done everything and been everywhere else. But the last thing I ever expected was to write a book about the woman behind the out-of-this-world smile. So how did it happen? Well, a few years ago, I was in Florence with my daughter, Julia, and she shares my love of Italian things. And I told her I was thinking of writing a biography of the real Mona Lisa. Now, Julia had two reactions, both of them perfectly understandable and legitimate. She said, Mom, you're going to write a biography of the real Mona Lisa? That's awesome. And I think she imagined me as a friend of mine did. She put together this image, and in Italian it says, attention, Diane Hales is about to reveal my story and my secrets. Now, Julia's other reaction came a little later, after about a 30-second pause, and she said, Mom, you're going to write a biography of the real Mona Lisa? Holy hell. And I think she thought it would lead to this strange morphing. Somebody on Facebook actually did this with my face, and I'm not sure if it's clever or creepy. But Julia turned out to be right on both counts. It did indeed turn into an awesome adventure, but it had quite a few holy hell moments along the way. So this evening, I'd like to take you along with me on my journey of discovery, one that I wouldn't have missed for the world. Now, I had to travel, of course, to her hometown. Now, Mona Lisa may be Florence's most famous daughter, but she has been almost invisible there. No street or monument bears her name. No plaques commemorate the places where she lived. To find Mona Lisa, I realized I would have to travel not just through space, but through time. Now, Lisa's life began in 1479 and ended in 1542, spanning the most tumultuous chapters in the history of Florence, decades of war, rebellion, invasion, siege, and conquest, and of the greatest artistic outpouring the world has ever seen. Now, Mona, by the way, simply means madam, and it's written in contemporary Italian with two N's. Mona with a single N, I have been told, is actually a vulgar word for a, let's say, a shady lady in certain dialects. Now, Mona descended from a family named the Gherardini, and they date back to a time before time. I came across a legend that traces Lisa Gherardini all the way back to the goddess Venus. Now, according to this tale, Aeneas, a son of Venus, who became a king of the Italian peninsula, divided his kingdom among his descendants, giving the land we know as Tuscany to Gherardo, who passed it on to his sons and the sons of his sons, the little Gherardos, or the Gherardini. So as a journalist, I found this interesting, but I wanted something more solid. And so I entered this rather fortress-like building. This is the State Archive in Florence. It contains an astounding 46 miles of diaries, manuscripts, ledgers, and other records kept by a population of obsessive note-takers. Now there, I was handed the oldest book I had ever touched, a 16th century history of Mona Lisa's family, written by one of her forefathers, one of her descendants. Now, as I learned, the social hierarchy at the time was pretty straightforward. There were men who prayed, men who labored, and men who fought. Women, rarely even mentioned, gave birth. Now, the Gherardini were fighters. They were knights who prided themselves on their fierceness and bravery. Some actually fought for the British King Henry II in his conquest of Ireland. And, as a sort of preparation, remember this for St. Patrick's Day, they established the dynasties of the Geraldines and the Fitzgeralds. Fitzgerald simply means son of Gerald. Now, other Gherardini stayed in Italy, and they conquered a wide swath of land in the Chianti region. But let me tell you, these were not the noble, gallant knights of Camelot. The Gherardini were constantly warring against rivals, ransacking the countryside, plundering abbeys and convents. Now, if merchants who were carrying goods from Siena to Florence refused to pay a toll to pass along their land, they would slash the heel tendons of the donkeys and seize their cargo. Of course, the town fathers of Florence had to clamp down, and so they razed the mightiest fortress castle of the Gherardini. The commune of Florence forced these rapper barons, all of them, including the Gherardini, they were hardly alone, to move into the town, where they immediately built armed towers like this one, and they fought with each other. Now, the Gherardini ranked as among the most pugnacious of Florentine clans. They were Guelphs, and they supported the Pope, so they fought against the Ghibellines, who backed the emperors. And once their side finally prevailed, they split into factions, the Blacks and the Whites, and they fought each other. Now, there was another famous Florentine, Dante Alighieri, and he belonged to the same political faction, the White Guelphs, as the Gherardini. And I think the poet may have been able to see into their souls. Here is what he wrote. Pride, envy, avarice, these are the sparks that have set on fire the hearts of all men. The Gherardini burned with all three. Nothing could match their fierce pride and spirit. They even coined a word for it, their Gherardinami, their Gherardininess. You can almost see it in this death mask of one of Mona Lisa's forefathers. Now, over time, the Gherardini lost power and wealth, but they never shed their fierce pride, and they seem to have passed it down from generation to generation. Now, I had never heard of the Gherardini or even given much thought to Mona Lisa's lineage until I visited this palazzo on Via Ghibellina. This is the home of an art historian named Ludovica Sebregondi, and she befriended me years ago when I was researching La Bella Lingua, and she invited me over to dinner. This just gives you a sense of the scale. And so at dinner, she casually mentioned that the mother of La Gioconda, as the Italians refer to Mona Lisa, grew up in this very building. I was surprised. Mona Lisa was an actual person? I asked. When she said yes, I immediately wanted to know more. Curiosity led me, via a typically Italian network of friends and friends of friends, to the world's expert on the Gherardini, Giuseppe Pallante. Now, tirelessly pursuing her family's parchment and paper trail, this sleuth has unearthed tax statements, real estate transfers, court proceedings, and records of baptisms, marriages, deaths. We met on a rooftop terrace overlooking Lisa's childhood neighborhood in the Old Trarno, the other or southern side of the Arno River. So Giuseppe had brought a tourist map of Florence, which he unfolded, and he said, "Would you like to know where she was born?" I said, "Oh, yes, of course." So he made an X to indicate the location of the house. It's a converted wool shop on a street called Via Squaza. I couldn't wait to see it. So the very next day, I made my way to this narrow lane off Via Maggio. Now, Squaza means wallow, and it lived up to its squalid name. More than 500 years after the residents complained of the stench from a clogged municipal drain, I can report that the street still stinks. It's actually a very sad little side street. The doors kind of splinter and sag on rusty hinges. There's graffiti smeared on the grimy houses. No one seemed to care about a girl named Lisa Gherardini, born centuries ago amid the clattering mills of Florence's cloth trade. Unexpectedly, I found that I did. The journalist in me immediately sensed that the flesh and blood woman born on this fetid block had a story of her own, stretching deep into the past and woven into the rich fabric of Florence's history. Determined to find out more, I began asking basic questions. Who was she, this ordinary woman who rose to such extraordinary fame? Who were her parents? Well, her father had a wonderful, melodious name, Anton Maria di Noldo Gherardini. He was a down-at-heel aristocrat, but if he bore any resemblance to this relative of his, this is Francesco Gherardini, painted by Titian in Venice in 1568. And as you can see, he is every inch the nobleman. Now, Anton Maria married three times, but his first two wives died in childbirth. We can only imagine his joy and relief on June 15, 1479, when a midwife gently washed his newborn daughter in warm white wine and lifted her into the light. Now, like all Christian fathers in Florence, Anton Maria faced a sacred duty to whisk his newborn to the baptistry of St. John before dangers or devils could snatch her eternal soul. Lisa's godparents, and she probably had two godmothers and a godfather, swept the newborn through Ghiberti's gleaming bronze doors. Now, one of the most exhilarating discoveries of my research was of Lisa's baptismal record in an ecclesiastical ledger. But I didn't come across it here. I found it online. Oh. And actually, it's the sixth line from the top, and it says, Lisa Camilla Gherardini, and it gives her father's name and a few more details. And I actually just exploded with excitement when I clicked on my computer. Here I was, 6,100 miles from Florence, in a country yet to be discovered at the time of her birth, and I was able to behold the original record of Lisa Gherardini's entry into the world. Well, that just led to more questions. I began to wonder, what was it like to be a little girl in Renaissance Florence? Now, as you can see, children of the Renaissance were dressed like miniature adults. As a girl, Lisa would have been bathed in rose water and rubbed with scented oil, so she always smelled like a flower. She learned to curtsy before she could count, and in her arms she would have cuddled her bambino, a terracotta figure of the infant Jesus dressed in velvet and brocade. As Lisa grew older, she would have learned to read and write, to memorize prayers and poems, to master basic arithmetic, to play an instrument and dance. But the city of artistic geniuses, great merchants, and brilliant humanists ranked, as one historian observes, among the most unlucky places in Europe to be born female. From birth to death, the fate of a Fiorentina like Lisa Gherardini depended on men. First, her father, whose primary duty was to find a mate who would most benefit the family. And then her husband, whose primary duty was to produce heirs. Florentine women, second-class citizens, really, couldn't buy property, vote, hold office, attend university, run a business, or even live independently. The more I read, and these were mainly American feminist scholars, the more depressed I became. And then one of my Italian friends suggested that I start talking to some Italian scholars to get a different perspective. What they told me was that although Renaissance women weren't liberated in our sense of the word, they were strong, and they constituted the very center of the most important social institution of the time, the family. Wives and mothers not only held up half the sky, they functioned as the glue that held all aspects of Florentine society together. And the impression they made on the men of the day remains indelible. When most people think of the Renaissance, what comes to mind? No, not the power brokers and the pontificating intellectuals who've long since slipped into obscurity. The images enshrined in our collective imagination are the female forms, like this of Giovanni Tornabuoni in a famous fresco by Ghirlandaio, and the statues that were created by Florentine artists. Yet none of these females is more recognizable than Lisa Gherardini. And I like to think that something set her apart. And not just her beauty, but her spirit, her Gherardininess. And as totally unscientific evidence, I offer this woman. Now, this is the face of an actress who happens to be one of Mona Lisa's descendants. The great-great-great-great to the 15th generation granddaughter. Her name is Natalia Guicciardini Strozzi, and I'm going to tell you more about her later. Now, however spirited Lisa may have been, her future held only two options. She could become a wife, or she could become a nun. Most girls married in their mid-teens. Any who remained single at 17 were considered no groom would want them. No clan would welcome them. Her own family couldn't keep a girl of that age. It would be a social disgrace. Now, marriage was strictly a business proposition in Florence. Fathers were expected to offer sizable dowries to attract suitors. Unfortunately, Anton Maria Gherardini had none for Lisa. Yet he managed to find her a husband, a silk merchant whose wife had died, leaving behind an infant son. His name was Francesco del Giocondo, and his great-grandfather was known simply as Jacopo. He was a wine barrel maker, and this was hard, sweaty, difficult work, but Jacopo was always so jovial that his customers nicknamed him Il Giocondo, the happy one, the merry one. And this nickname passed down to his sons and his grandsons, the del Giocondo. Now, Francesco, I assure you, did not inherit his great-grandfather's amiable personality. He was actually the most litigious merchant in the merchant's court. He actually sued something like 68 times, and he was always blustering through town, chasing down creditors. But yet, I had to base my impression of him on something, and so I turned to another Ghirlandaio fresco. This is the Adoration of the Magi. And these three men, they're all leading members of the Silk Guild to which Francesco belonged. You can see the two older men. They have these plush cloaks and their elaborate hats filled with precious jewels. But I peg the younger guy in the center, the one in the plain black cap, as a Francesco del Giocondo type. Neither handsome nor ugly, clean-shaven, sallow skin, downcast eyes. And even though he was always pouncing on profits wherever he could find them, he may have considered Lisa's beauty more valuable currency than a cash dowry. Now, courtship in Renaissance Florence was like an elaborate dance. Wooing a beloved from the street below her balcony was not something that Shakespeare invented for Romeo and Juliet. It really was an old Italian tradition. So soon after exchanging a formal handshake with his future father-in-law, Francesco del Giocondo would have made his way to stand below the windows of the rooms the Gherardini were renting at the time. From these very windows, Lisa may have looked down upon the man who wanted her as his wife. Did she have any say in the matter? Absolutely not. Now, Lisa, like many brides of her day, was just a teenager. She was 15 years old. It's not surprising that the girls actually packed their little dolls from girlhood in their marriage chests when they moved to their husbands' houses. But still, their wedding day was the greatest day of their lives. It was the most exciting. And as a bride, Lisa would have ridden a white charger at the head of a jubilant parade of cousins and sisters and in-laws and friends and musicians and merrymakers. She would have gone through all the landmarks of Florence, and I traced her trail, and it led to Via della Stufa. Now, Lisa started her new life, not just with Francesco, but with his entire family. Parents, siblings, their spouses, his son, assorted servants. This street has been drastically renovated since the 1500s, but a city engineer told me that the apartment building I'm standing in front of here, number 23, is probably close to the site of the Del Giocondo home. Well, on my most recent visit, I was passing by, and the door was open. I couldn't resist peeking in. Now, even though these may not be the original beams or columns, I kind of gave myself goosebumps just thinking that Lisa Gherardini had occupied this very plot of Florentine real estate. Now, to get a better idea, though, of what her actual home would have looked like, I went to the Palazzo d'Avanzati. It's a museum of the old houses. That's how it translates in Florence. And as you can see, it would have been not grand, but cozy and comfortable. And with her marriage, Lisa certainly moved up in the world. She had fewer menial chores. She enjoyed more creature comfort. She probably slept on a soft bed rather than a mat on the floor. And she definitely dressed better because that was expected of a merchant's wife. But Lisa also had to learn the rules of marriage. A husband, according to the day's conventional wisdom, commanded a household like a king reigning over a kingdom or a captain steering a ship. Clerics and counselors bombarded wives with advice. Laugh at his jokes. Do not be joyful if he is sad or sad if he is joyful. Do not prattle. Be like the moon rather than the sun and shine only in his reflected light. Now, what about the most intimate aspects of married life? I couldn't resist asking an expert on medieval and Renaissance sexuality a question that took her by surprise. How was Mona Lisa's sex life? Well, after she stopped giggling, she said, probably not very exciting. Rather than mere double standards for men and women, Florence provided two distinct varieties of sexual experience, recreational and procreational. Now, the former was reserved primarily for educated and affluent young Florentine men who were considered by their elders to be, and I quote, sex-obsessed, hot-tempered idiots, not yet intellectually mature, emotionally sensible, or politically responsible. Once they had sown several fields of wild oats, Florentine men were expected to assume the steadying yoke of marriage and fulfill their fundamental, sacred, and civic duty of procreation, although that didn't necessarily mean they gave up all of their recreational pursuits. For women, procreation was a career. From menarche to age 40, a typical Florentine woman became pregnant every 13 to 14 months. A wife's ultimate goal was to bring new life, preferably male life, into the world. Now, as I discovered in the digital archives of Florence, there were manuals, how-to books on everything, including sort of the equivalent of what to expect when you're expecting. Praise God for the good news, read the first line of one such guide. A pregnant woman reigned as the queen of the household, pampered and protected. Now, although I laughed when I heard it, Florentines took seriously the claim that a woman once gave birth to a mouse after being frightened by one during pregnancy. Now, childbirth was harrowing and highly perilous. One in four Florentine mothers died in labor. Now, typically, women gave birth in the company of other women, a midwife, their mother, their sisters, their female relatives. But men wrote the advice books. I knew that the moment I read this little suggestion for a woman in labor. Climb onto a dresser or other high piece of furniture and jump to the floor, repeating this several times. If all this climbing and jumping becomes too tiring, get hold of a pair of stilts. Stand on them on the points of your toes, kick your legs in the air, and jump down to the ground, landing on your heels. Now, I don't think that Lisa Gherardini ever followed this outrageous recommendation. She gave birth to six children, three girls and three boys. And like other women in labor, I think Lisa would have turned for comfort and strength to Mary, the mother of Jesus. And few Madonnas are more exquisite than this one by Leonardo da Vinci. Nothing about this artist and architect, musician and mathematician, scientist and scholar was ever ordinary. He was the consummate Renaissance man. He sketched, designed, painted, and sculpted like no one else. He looked like no one else, with carefully curled locks in his youth and a prophet's beard in old age. He rode like a champion. And a biographer claimed that he was so strong he could bend a horseshoe with his hands. Now, through much of Lisa's life, Leonardo was living in Milan, working under the patronage of Duke Ludovica Sforza. These were his wonder years. For almost two full and fulfilling decades, he delved deep into mathematics and science. He designed prototypes for a helicopter and submarine, produced stunning portraits, including these two, of mistresses of Duke Ludovica. But nothing is more wondrous than his most acclaimed masterpiece. Leonardo brought this painting such remarkable verisimilitude that Christ and his apostles seem to breathe as they gather for their last supper together. Then life turned on a dime, or a ducat, because the French invaded Milan in 1499. They captured Duke Sforza. Leonardo fled, and he had nowhere to go but the town where he had trained as an artist. Now, Leonardo, as you probably know, was illegitimate. He was born to a country woman in the town of Vinci. He was raised by his paternal grandparents. His father became a notary. He was named Ser Piero, and he never acknowledged Leonardo as his legitimate heir, although he did recognize his talent and bring him to Florence to apprentice with Verrocchio. Now, by the time of Leonardo's return in 1500, his father had remarried several times and headed a bustling household of 11 children, ranging in age from 2 to 22. Leonardo couldn't go home again, but he found a home in a beloved shrine. This is Santissima Annunziata, the Most Holy Annunciation. And here, the lives of three men converge. It just so happened that Francesco del Giocondo, Lisa's husband, supplied linens and loans to the friars. Ser Piero da Vinci, Leonardo's father, handled their business and legal affairs. And Leonardo took up residence in return for a promise to paint an altarpiece for the impressive church. Now, art historians speculate that during his stay in Santissima Annunziata, Leonardo's father may have introduced his illustrious son to Francesco del Giocondo as a potential patron. We do have documentary evidence confirming a commission. It was only found about a decade ago, and it describes Leonardo working on a portrait of Lisa del Giocondo commissioned by her husband, and it was dated October 1503. Lisa was 24 and had already given birth to 5 children. Leonardo was 51 and a living legend. And what we've been talking about ever since is, why her? I wonder if Leonardo, the master of knowing how to see, might have glimpsed more than what met others' eyes in this seemingly ordinary woman. A flicker, perhaps, of the indomitable spirit that family members called their Gherardinami, their Gherardininess. Now, the art historian Giorgio Vasari describes a scene of Leonardo painting Mona Lisa and bringing in performers to sing and play and make her merry so she wouldn't be afflicted by melancholy. Now, scholars sort of deride this fanciful idea, but Leonardo was attempting to do something that had never been done before, to capture real human thoughts and emotions. Eventually, Leonardo and Lisa's lives diverged. He was summoned back to Milan to complete a commission in 1506. And then he was forced to leave that city when the French were once again banished from it. He went to Rome for a while. His final patron, though, as he got older, and he described himself as feeling the bite of the teeth of time, but his final patron was King Francis I of France, and he brought Leonardo to the Loire Valley. And it was here that Leonardo died and was buried in 1519 at age 67. Meanwhile, Lisa resumed her life on Via della Stufa. In 1507, she gave birth to another son who lived only a month. Her husband became involved in politics as a Medici supporter, and as their fortunes rose, so did his. Now, he just kept blustering around town, always having one scam or another. But there was a bigger scandal that would rock the family, one caused by Lisa's little sister, the sister. Now, as I said before, girls with no dowries, no suitors, and no acceptable place to go had to enter convents. At one time, half of the daughters of Florence's merchant class ended up in nunneries. Now, two of Lisa's sisters went into the convent of San Domenico. And this is located in the open countryside between the church and the city walls. Now, one of them, Camilla, was a part of a group of 4 young women who, on a spring night in 1512, awaited, dressed as brides with golden ruffs, as 4 young swains climbed a ladder they had hidden on the premises to their second floor rooms. There they remained for 3 to 4 hours, engaging in what an observer hidden in the shadows called obscenities. Now, the Florentine vice squad came and arrested the 4 men who were sentenced and fined. The nuns were acquitted of any civic wrong duty, but they faced the wrath of God and, probably even more terrifying, their mother superior. Now, Francesco del Giocondo was a foresighted father, and he had set aside funds for a dowry for his oldest daughter. However, even though he was professionally successful and Lisa had the Gherardini pedigree, they decided not to seek a husband. Instead, they placed the 12-year-old girl in the same convent as her aunts and great-aunts. We have to struggle with understanding the reasons why, and as I tried to, I visited the former cloister. It's now a forensic medicine institute on a quiet side street that seems very distant from the grit and gridlock of modern Florence. On this once hallowed ground, the mother and me could understand how, in a world of unseen and unforeseeable dangers, I would want my daughter safe within these walls. But if this was Mona Lisa's hope, she would face bitter disappointment. Her daughter died in 1518 at age 19, perhaps of the plague or another deadly infectious disease. Francesco and Mona Lisa were survivors. They lived through Florence's darkest hours, including the harrowing siege of Florence in 1530. one of her relatives trained the young men to fight the Medici. He was later beheaded as a traitor. Now, Francesco kept blustering through the town, and he managed to acquire such a sizable fortune that he could afford a private chapel behind the altar of Santissima Annunziata. Now, it takes some doing to get there, but I actually slipped inside, and even inside the little confessional where Mona Lisa might have also sought a confessor's pardon. Now, there is a marker on the floor that indicates that it once belonged to the Del Giocondo, and this marker stayed in place for centuries, until just about a year ago, when a crew of self-styled bone seekers removed it in the hope of taking out skeletons in an attempt to match DNA from Lisa's biological son, buried here along with many others, to the remains of female skeletons exhumed from a convent across town. But Lisa never has been buried here, even though that is exactly what her husband specified in his will. Lisa outlived Francesca by 4 years, and even though he wanted her to live with their son in the home, family home, and to be buried at his side, she had a different idea. She chose instead to live the last 2 years of her life and to be buried in the company of the nuns of the convent of Santa Ursula, just a short block from her home on Via della Stufa. This is what it looks like today. Really, it's just a blighted urban ruin. But once, Santa Ursula was an exclusive finishing school for the daughters of Florence's elite, famous for the nuns' skills at embroidery and at cultivating medicinal herbs. Now, Santa Ursula has suffered centuries of neglect. An editorial writer branded it La Vergogna di Florence, di Firenze, the shame of Florence. And I agree, but by a wonderful coincidence, last fall I was in Florence, and for the first time in decades, Santa Ursula opened to the public. One of the organizers of the events described it as horrible and yet magnificent. It was indeed both wonderful and eerie to hear the sounds of a piano concert, and there was even a play based on the story of Mona Lisa's daughter, who lived here as a nun. Now, in the play, there's a dialogue, and people come up to this young woman, and they say, "Who was your mother?" And she replies, "The most beautiful woman in the world." "Where is she?" they ask. "Museum," she says. "What did they leave? What did she leave you?" "Only her smile." Now, Mona Lisa was buried here in Santa Ursula, and she died, actually she was around age 63 when she died. And in the last few years, the same self-proclaimed bones hunters have opened the graves of the underground cemetery and carried away several skeletons in a highly controversial attempt to identify her bones. Do any of these bones really belong to Lisa Gherardini? No one knows. Hundreds of women lived and died at the convent. DNA tests are underway, and maybe or not, they'll prove useful. But the question that the Florentines ask is, why can't Lisa Gherardini rest in peace? Well, the same could be asked of her portrait. The French king, Francis I, paid the equivalent of $10 million for the painting, and he installed Mona Lisa at Fontainebleau. Now, I'd like to say that she hung in a throne room or a public chamber. No, Francis put her in one of his bathing suites, where he and his guests soaked and smoked and gambled and sweated. As you might imagine, decades of high humidity took a terrible toll on the painted lady. So attempting to repair the damage, a restorer applied a thick coat of lacquer. It fractured into a web of thread-like fissures. We haven't seen Mona Lisa without this veil since. So the French monarchs inherited the painting, and they passed it on, and some idolized it, some were indifferent. But one of its greatest admirers was Napoleon. He actually called it Madame Lisa and ordered the portrait hung in his paint in his bedroom at the Tuileries Palace. He also became infatuated with a beautiful young woman in his sister's court. He called her La Belle Italienne, and she happened to be a descendant of Lisa Gherardini. She resisted all of his pleas, and so he had to settle for the painting. After Napoleon's exile, the portrait returned to the Louvre. And it was pretty much ignored until Romanticism swept across Europe in the 19th century. Lisa's became the face that launched a thousand fantasies. Suitors bearing flowers and impassioned notes climbed the grand staircase at the Louvre to gaze into her limpid and burning eyes. Lovers, poets, dreamers go and die at her feet, a French curator wrote, and he wasn't exaggerating. An artist threw himself from his fourth-floor window, leaving a farewell note that said, "For years I have grappled desperately with her smile. I prefer to die." And then she was gone. In August 1911, the Mona Lisa disappeared. Tabloids churned out reams of copy on the heist of the century, and millions mourned as if a person, not a painting, had gone missing. The unlikely thief was Vincenzo Perugia, an Italian handyman who hid the Mona Lisa in his cheap rooms in Paris for more than 2 years. Then he toted the portrait to Florence in hopes of a reward. Instead, he was arrested. His excuse, "I fell in love with her smile." Now, the Louvre welcomed back their adopted daughter, but something had changed. By the time of her return to the Louvre, Mona Lisa was more than just a work of art. She had become art's first mass celebrity, famous for being famous, part of the public domain that anyone could mock, like this postcard maker from that time. You can see poor Leonardo leading back his wayward daughter to the museum. Well, then the artists had a go with her. We had Dali, Cubist, we had Warhol. The most outrageous spoofs even stripped Lisa of her humanity. They turned her into a conehead, a duck face. The worst is called monkeying around. Advertisers jumped on the bandwagon. She's really sold a lot of hair products over the year. L.A., this is a restaurant that gave her the L.A. look. Here in Northern California, Clover milk from Mona Lisa. And I was at a beautiful winery in Sonoma County, and when I went out in search of a restroom, I found the Porta Lisa, an artful restroom from people who care. The portrait has also been translated into jelly beans, Legos. Here we have Toast, a very ambitious grass portrait. And of course, we all remember Mona Monica. More recently, Lady Gaga has taken to wearing a bit of Mona Lisa. I like to think that Mona Lisa is just a gal like us. She likes to put her feet up at the end of the day. And now that it's become trendy to take selfies with works of art, she's kind of gotten into that too. Now, people ask me if they should trek to Paris to see her in her temperature-controlled, bulletproof glass case. And I say, sure, but be ready for that. So, there are 9 million visitors a year, and I say that if you want to find the real Mona Lisa, you should go back to Florence, where I'm trying to go. And finally, her old neighborhood is celebrating Mona Lisa as their native daughter. June 15th has become the official Mona Lisa's Day. And this past year, by the way, she just turned 535, and they put up a plaque in her memory. Yet the only place you'll find her likeness is by the street artists. But there is another way, another place to look, and that's in Lisa's family tree. After her death, Lisa's granddaughter gave birth to a new generation, and then there was another and another. And the family married into a veritable who's who of distinguished clans, including there's a Count of the Guicciardini, there's a Principessa of the Strozzi, there was even an ancestor of Sir Winston Churchill. In search of her contemporary descendants, my husband and I drove off through Tuscany's postcard pretty hills, and we made our way to this fairy tale castle. This is the home of the Guicciardini Strozzi Winery. And there we met two radiant young women. There's Natalia on the left. She trained and danced as a professional ballerina. And her sister Irina on the right has degrees from Italy's distinguished Bocconi University. She helps to run the family wine business. The girls, the young women, were so delightful that I began to wonder if maybe this was the Gherardini spirit that had so intrigued Leonardo. And even though they're very proud of all their connections with Mona Lisa, they were dubious. They said, no, 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 we may have something in our DNA, but really it doesn't affect who we are as people in today's world. Now, there are generic resemblances. They have dark hair, they have dark eyes, but as Natalia put it, have you ever seen so many teeth? Now, they told me that their father was the one who smiled like La Gioconda, but he was tied up in meetings. And so we hugged and said arrivederci, and I took my leave. And then I remembered that I had forgotten my sunglasses. So I dashed back to the Castello, and I burst into a courtyard where a tall, silver-haired man stood with his back toward me. He turned around, and I realized I was looking at Principe Strozzi. And I wondered, could that be it? Is that the smile of a Mona Lisa? Well, it was a special thrill for me last fall to return and to present them with a variation on the talk I'm giving tonight. And I felt such a bond with Natalia because we're both fascinated by her famous grandmother. Now, I'm happy to say that she now, I feel that Lisa has returned to the streets of Florence. This is the book in one of the bookstores in the city. And it's also true in the United States. Mona Lisa was one of Amazon's best books of 2014 in arts, and she made her way into quite a few publications. The New York Post managed to weave a tabloid twist. They got sex and death into there. Now, people asked me, though, what was the most surprising thing I learned? And it has nothing to do with Mona Lisa. It's something that Natalia Guicciardini Strozzi told me, which was that the people of Florence are like their palazzi. They're very formidable and cold on the outside. But once you get inside, you find the most wonderful treasures. And so it was a real treat for me to present at the Sala delle Muse, which is the room in which the first opera was performed. And I really felt that Mona Lisa deserved to be there. I was very careful not to sing. And yet my connection with Mona Lisa just seems to continue. After this trip, I went to Rome, and I was walking on the street, and I saw this poster for an exhibit on Via Margutta. And I went inside, and I saw these three-dimensional paintings. And this blind man took my hands, and he pushed them very gently over every single inch of the painting. And I felt that I was seeing the Mona Lisa in a whole new way. And that really is why I wrote the book. I wanted people to see not just a work of art, but a real woman. Now, usually, I end my presentation here, but I thought, this is the Commonwealth Club. I've got to give them more celebrities. And so I'm going to tell you a story that I usually don't tell, and it's based on my first book, La Bella Lingua. And there it is in a bookstore in Florence, and I have gotten hundreds of responses to it from people around the world. It's a biography of the language. And one last summer came from a man named Kevin in London. And he told me that he had gotten on a train at Paddington Station, and he had a very Harry Potter-like experience. He had placed his rucksack up above, and when he went to retrieve it, La Bella Lingua fell into his arms. Now, most people would have just tossed it aside. But he said it was like manna from heaven because he had a longtime partner from Sicily who had been trying to get him to learn Italian for decades, and Kevin had given up time and time again. Well, he read La Bella Lingua, which is not a book on how to learn Italian, but really why to learn Italian, and it just made his life so much more wonderful. He could visit his partner's family. So Kevin and I became Facebook friends. And a few months ago, I started seeing that on Facebook, he was getting all these congratulations. You know, the things British people say, bloody good show, that sort of thing. And so I asked Kevin what was going on. And he told me that he had been knighted. Well, I told him that I, too, am a knight. And I wrote to Kevin and said, I'll show you my medals if you show me yours. And these are mine. And here is Kevin with his partner. And you can see they really do it upright. This is Buckingham Palace. But he didn't tell me why he had been knighted. So when I pressed him, he said, well, I was knighted for 30 years of service to the family. Well, the only British family I know is this one. Well, those of you who like Downton Abbey know this man, Carson. Turns out, Kevin is Carson to this man. And the story doesn't quite end there, because last fall the BBC chose Mona Lisa as one of its books of the week and read it on air. So Kevin told me that he was late. And when he came in, the boss, as he calls him, said, "Kevin, what is this? You've never been late in your 30 years of work before." And he said, "Well, it's all Diane Hale's fault." And as a result, I have been invited to go and tour Hightower, which I certainly plan to do next in the coming spring. But that's not all. I wanted to also tell you that for me, one of the joys of this book was really walking the streets of Florence and getting to know Lisa's neighborhoods. And so I'm working with a guide, and we're putting together tours of Mona Lisa Florence. So if you are in Florence, it'd be just a nice little half-day trip. And the guide is absolutely terrific, and I think you would enjoy it. And you can find out more. I'm online at dianehales.com or Bloodbelt. I'm very easy to find. And really, though, what I take away from this whole experience is that one of the things about writing books that I absolutely love is that they keep leading you new places. They lead you to lovely people and wonderful experiences. And I consider being here with you tonight one of those. So thank you very much. I really appreciate your coming.
To remind our online and radio audiences that they are listening to Diane Hales at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco talking about our book, Mona Lisa, Life Discovered. And for the questions, please use the mic.
Hi. I loved it, Diane. I mean, I have a love of Italy right now just listening to you. I wanted to ask you, what spurred you to love Italy so much to start your first book and this book? Because your face radiates when you talk about it. So can you tell us what brought you to the whole thing about Italy?
Well, my agent said the same thing, because I've been writing books for many years, and my agent said, whenever you talk about Italy, you light up. So why don't you write a book about it? And I said, I can't, because they've all been written. And she said, well, but you study Italian. You really, nobody has written about studying Italian. And so I thought, I wonder if there's a story behind the Italian language. And there was. There's always a story in Italy. And I think that it was this wonderful combination of the culture, the people. And I, at first, felt great trepidation. I thought, what chutzpah? I happen to be 100% Polish. And here I am writing about Italy in Italian. And instead, Italians have embraced it and said it's more of a compliment. If we said these things about our language, it would seem like braggadocio. But when you say it, it's more credible. And so that's what brought me to Italy.
Hi, Mama.
You aren't allowed to ask questions.
Well, your past two books have been so wonderful and brought so much joy to many people. I wonder if there's going to be another.
Why would she ask that question? There are two reasons why she's asking that question. My next book is a collaboration with my daughter, Julia. And it's a college stress. It's a college textbook. It's on personal stress management. And then I do want to return to Italy. And what is intriguing me now is what really sets Italy apart from everywhere else is la passione. And so I really want to write about Italian passions.
Any other questions?
Well, there's another question that I know you had before, and this concerns the fact that. That there, every now and then, this scurrilous rumor enters the press that Mona Lisa is really a man. And it is not necessarily that new, but the most, there's a man named Silvano Vincetti. He's the man behind all these bone seekers. And he's like a one-man theory, theory machine about who Mona Lisa can be and what's going on in the painting. And so he based all of this, the conjecture, on the fact that the proportions are the same of her face and the alleged self-portraits of Leonardo. But Leonardo also worked out the ideal. And art historians tell me that the proportions are always the same, that you can find those similarities. But what's interesting is that when I was doing my research on Labella Lingua, I met a scholar, an American scholar who spent 40 years in Florence, who's the definitive expert on Leonardo. And we sat down for coffee, and he said, "You are going to hate what I have to say." And I said, "Okay, try me." And he said, "I am 99.9% sure that the woman in the painting is not Luisa Gherardini del Giocondo." And I thought, wow. Well, I said, then I have a really good story, because obviously that's the biggest hoax in art history. And so then around a week later, I got an email from him saying, "This is really embarrassing, but I am now 99.9% sure that she is the woman in the painting." And the reason was the discovery of a letter that concerned her, and that he made me promise I could not write about. And I didn't. But he published the paper this past month, and there is a letter from a Strozzi and a Medici talking about Luisa Gherardini and her portrait, and saying that that both of them had hit on her. And so there really is something to her and her Gherardini spirit and her smile, and that she, I must say, in her defense, refused them.
Well, because there's always that rumor about it wasn't Lisa, it was somebody
yes.
else.
Yes, and we're getting more and more evidence saying that it is she.
The proportions in the Leonardo da Vinci used go back to Pythagoras in terms of
the mathematics.
Beauty, yeah, the mathematics. So that's not really good. Yeah, that's not a good argument. You can use it for all of them.
Yes.
It wasn't what we really had. So, thought we were good.
Mm-hmm.
So one last question. We have time for one last question or one last.
I was just going to say I'd be happy to sign any books and. And thank you all for coming again.
Thank you. That's Jennifer Brennan. So Diane will be out in the lobby. And I thank you very much for coming to enjoy this talk in the 113th year of the enlightened discussion of ideas at the Commonwealth Club of California.